the workman's or labourer's boots. That meant that someone had been trying to see in through that window while we had been away.
Chapter 21. Hugo. December 1944. Hugo's leg was definitely on the mend. He still couldn't put any weight on it, but at least it didn't throb violently all the time, and the fever had not returned. In the morning, he made himself get up and practice walking with the stick. The sun had been streaming in through the broken masonry, but when he came outside, he stopped and gasped in surprise. Below him, the world lay in a sea of white fog. Only the very tip of the church bell tower rose above it, and in the distance were the crests of other hills. This seemed like a perfect moment to try and explore, knowing he couldn't be seen from below. The ground was frosty, and he moved cautiously, hopping around the ruined buildings, looking for anything that might be useful. He found a cooking pot, another spoon, and, to his delight, a tin of something. He couldn't tell what, because the label had been destroyed, but that encouraged him to keep looking. He tucked his finds inside his jacket and ventured further. He spotted a boot sticking out from under a chunk of masonry. The other of the pair might be nearby. It would be a useful commodity for Sophia to trade. He used all his strength to move the piece of stone aside, then recoiled in horror when he saw that the boot was still attached to a leg. He had forgotten that the Allies had bombed a German gun position. There would certainly be other bodies buried here. This knowledge took away the childish excitement he had felt at making discoveries. He carried his new treasures back to his lair and set about making a snare to catch a pigeon. His plan was simple enough. A stick to prop up the drawer he had salvaged from the rubble, a length of parachute cord tied to it to be jerked away when the pigeon went inside to peck at the crumbs he would leave. He cut away the parachute cord, and then, having his knife handy, remembered that Sophia had expressed a desire for some of the silk to make underwear. He no longer needed the parachute now that she had brought him bedding, so he cut it up into usable pieces, smiling with anticipation at the thought of her face when she saw it. He set up his trap and sprinkled the ground with breadcrumbs, then retreated into his hiding place. Now all he had to do was wait. The morning passed. He tried not to move or make a noise. Twice a pigeon flapped about, and once it landed on a beam but then flew off again. Finally, it landed close to the trap. It walked forward, cooing throatily. For a moment he admired the iridescence of its feathers, and was loath to kill it. But he forced these thoughts from his mind. Sophia needed meat. He could provide it. The pigeon waddled under the drawer and started to peck at the crumbs. He jerked at the cord. The stick flew out. The drawer landed with a resounding crash, trapping the pigeon. It had worked exactly as he had hoped. He half crawled, half slithered over to it, lifted the drawer enough to slide his hand in, and grabbed the pigeon. It fluttered and struggled as he brought it out. But he wrung its neck, and it lay still. He stared at it, realizing it was the first time he had killed anything with his bare hands. As a boy at home, he had known that pigs and chickens were killed on the farms around him. As a bomber pilot, he had certainly killed when he dropped bombs on convoys and rail yards. But that was remote and impersonal. This was different. He was appalled at how easy it was to take a life. But that thought was displaced by the thought of Sophia's face when she saw what he had for her. It was the first time he had been able to give her anything in return. This thought made him remember her excitement about the parachute silk. A double gift. It made him absurdly happy. He lay back, exhausted, and tried to remember presents he had given Brenda. Had she been thrilled with them? In the early days, when they were in love, he had painted her portrait. She'd liked that. But later? And he realized with a nagging sense of shame that his gifts had been routine, without much thought to them. Expensive perfume, a pair of silk stockings. If they had grown apart, it was his fault as much as hers. After the war, I will make it up to her. And to little Teddy, he thought. And Sophia. The words whispered somewhere in his head. see her again. Rubbish, he told himself. You can't be in love with Sophia. She's been wonderfully kind when you needed help, but you've known her only a couple of weeks at the most, and you're weak and ill. It's quite common for men to fall in love with their nurses. He pushed the thought aside until she came to him that night. Sophia's face, when he handed her his two gifts, was so alight with joy that he felt his heart melting, as if it had been frozen in ice for too long, and had now returned to the heart of a young Hugo, heading out into the world amazed by beauty, hopeful for the future.
"A pigeon?" she said. "How did you manage to catch a pigeon?"
"Oh, simple, really. I set up a trap. The pigeon came and took the bait." He grinned. "Let us hope he has brothers and sisters."
"I can make a good stew with this. Good broth," she said. "My son Renzo is looking so frail lately. His sore throat and coughing do not go away. This will do him good. And you too."
"No," he insisted. "Keep it for Renzo and the grandmother. And yourself. It's a gift."
"Nonsense," she said. "We'll all share in the bounty."
Then she fingered the pieces of parachute.
"So soft. So luxurious," she said. "I will make the best petticoat and drawers with this."
She held it up to her face, smiling at him.
"It is too bad. It will not be seemly to show you when I have finished the garments."
Her look was definitely flirtatious. "Well, not to mention too cold," he pointed out, and she laughed.
"That too."
Then she grew thoughtful.
"Maybe I can use some of this silk to barter for things that we need, like more olive oil. I know that the Bernardinis have jars hidden in their basement. Gina Bernardini loves nice things."
She paused, looking up at him.
"What do you think?"
"Well, they would know that the silk came from a parachute. Therefore, they would know that I am here."
"But if I said that I found the parachute up in the forest?"
"Well, they would know that a man escaped and was in the area. Then someone would tell the Germans, and they would come looking for me." She sighed.
"You are right. It is a risk I cannot take."
Then she brightened up again.
"But when the Germans finally go, and the Allies come, we shall still be bartering, and I will still keep some silk just in case."
Hugo finished the polenta and olive spread she had brought for him, and handed her back the cloth they had been wrapped in. She folded it, then looked up and said,
"Do you think of your wife all the time, the way I think of my Guido?"
"No," he said. "I'm afraid I don't. Not often. Not often enough."
"You're not happy in your marriage?"
"Not really. We're too different, I suppose. We met when we were both students in Florence. In England, I'd probably never have met her. I come from a noble family, and hers was, well, lower middle class, I suppose you could say. Her father worked in a bank, a bank clerk. Nothing wrong with it, but we would never have met. But we both shared a passion for art, and she was nice-looking, good legs. She loved to have fun, to go out dancing and drinking wine. I suppose we were two foreigners drawn together, more because we were in a strange land." He paused, looking at her, wanting her to understand. "I expect at the end of our year in Florence, we would eventually have parted and gone our separate ways. But we were young and inexperienced. When Brenda announced that she was expecting a child, I did the right thing. I married her. We lived in London for a while. I painted. I worked in an art gallery. The baby was born. Things were fine."
"And then?"
she asked.
"Something went wrong?"
"And then my father's health declined. He'd been gassed in the Great War, you know. He called me home and said he needed me at Langley Hall because he could no longer run the estate. So I brought Brenda and the child to live in the country in a great big house. She never liked it. Too far from the bright lights and city life and fun. And she never really got along with my father."
"So what will happen when you go home?"
"I don't know," he said. "I'll just have to see."
"At least she likes art. That is a good thing," Sophia said. "Tell me about your art. and your studies. I would love to know more.
Not now. You need your sleep. Go home, he said.
Oh, but I love to hear about art, she said. We live in an area of great art, you know. Michelangelo, Leonardo, Fra Angelico, Botticelli.
He was surprised. He wondered what farm girl in England could reel off the names of English painters. You know about art? She shrugged.
Their paintings are in our churches. I went to Florence once on a school trip before the war. I couldn't believe that anyone could paint such lovely things. And sculpture. Have you seen Michelangelo's David? The nuns said we weren't to look because he was naked. But he was beautiful, was he not?
So you looked, he laughed. She gave an embarrassed smile.
I was only studying great art. That is not a sin. Do you paint naked bodies?
He laughed again. I'm afraid I don't. The people in my landscapes are fully clothed.
I wish I could see your paintings, she said. If I could find you some paints and paper, you could paint the landscape here. It is very beautiful, is it not?
It is, he agreed. But paints and paper are the least of our worries. He took her hand and she led him. You really should go, he said. You will be ill if you don't get enough sleep.
Nonna told me I was becoming lazy because I did not wake until 7, she said. She is always up at 5. That is how it was in the old days. She is 81 and still expects to help in the fields. She has been urging me to harvest the turnips, saying she feels useless, stuck indoors with nothing to do.
And are the turnips ready for harvest?
Soon, before Christmas. That will be good. Maybe I can trade for things that we need for the holiday. It is so strange. In past years, we would all be baking at this moment. Now it will be only chestnut cake, if we are lucky. No dried fruit, no cream, no butter, and probably no meat. A poor feast.
Let us hope it will be the last poor feast before the Germans are finally defeated. Sophia crossed herself.
From your lips to God's ears, she said.
Chapter 22. Joanna. June, 1973. It's easy enough to explain that boot print, I thought. The two Carabinieri agents would obviously want to search the crime scene for clues. They may have dusted my window for fingerprints. But then if it wasn't an official search, someone was watching the house and saw me leave. I glanced around and was relieved when I heard Paola's voice calling for Angelina to bring a bowl. I hurried to join her, and soon she was showing me how to choose the zucchini blossoms and how to pick them, making sure that the stem was intact. After that, she cut a few artichokes, dug up some radishes, and chose a couple of ripe tomatoes. Then she stopped by the herb garden and picked various leaves that I couldn't identify, but their scent was pungent when she gave them to me to hold. Finally, we walked back to the house. I found myself looking around to see if we were being watched. Paola chatted away as we walked, telling Angelina about our encounter with the Carabinieri and what the townspeople had been saying. "You see, I was right," Angelina said. "I told you that it was because Gianni kept bad company. He liked to flirt with danger. That's why he was killed." "But why choose my well? That's what I'd like to know," Paola said. "Why not kill him on his own property? It is more remote, less likely to be seen among those trees. Why not just follow him there?" "Perhaps he saw he was being followed. Perhaps he fought back and had to be killed in a hurry," Angelina shrugged. "Let's get on with the meal, Mamma. I am hungry, and I'm sure Signorina Joanna is too." "Then lay the table and slice the bread," Paola said, going ahead of us into the cool kitchen. "And put out the salami and the cheese and wash those radishes." She turned to me. "Now pay attention if you want to see how we stuff the zucchini blossoms, Joanna." She put some of the white cheese into a bowl, chopped up and added some of the herb I had now decided was mint, then grated some lemon zest onto it. Then she took a spoon and carefully stuffed this mixture into each of the blossoms. She dipped a scoop into the big jar of olive oil and lit the gas under a pan. "Now the batter," she said, She broke an egg into flour, whisked the mixture, and added water. Then she took a zucchini blossom and dipped it into the batter. When the oil was sizzling, she dropped the blossom in and repeated the same process with the others, one by one, turning them and then removing them when they were crisp.
"Tonight we do the same with the artichokes," she said. "We need to eat these while they are good and hot."
We sat at the table. Bread was passed to me along with sliced tomatoes with rich, sweet vinegar poured over them. I took my first bite of the zucchini blossom. "Very delicious," I said, wishing my Italian vocabulary of praise was more extensive. We ate for a while in silence until the baby's cries made Angelina jump up to fetch her.
"She went 3 hours between feeds this time. That is good news, eh, Mama?"
"Yes, she is certainly growing stronger," Paola said. "I think now we can safely say that she has come to stay."
We finished our meal with apricots.
"Now, a little siesta before we pick the vegetables and load up the cart for tomorrow," Paola said. "I expect you are tired too, mia cara."
I didn't like the thought of Paola and Angelina going off to sleep and leaving me alone. "Not really," I said. "I think I will sit in the shade of the front porch and read my book."
"As you wish. Myself, I need to sleep."
I went to the front porch and sat on the bench in the shade. It was cool and peaceful. Bees were buzzing around jasmine. Sparrows chirped as they hopped around in the dust. In the distance, I heard a donkey braying, but I could not read or relax. I found myself glancing up from the book, my eyes on the path that led down from the village. I tried to make sense of what had happened. Nobody in San Salvatore seemed to have met my father, or even knew of him. And yet Gianni had tried his best to get me alone and tell me something important, something he had kept hidden until now for fear of his life. And then there was the beautiful boy, the boy my father had hidden where only he and Sophia could find him. But the only boy was Renzo, and he did not remember being hidden away, nor did he remember my father. And he was too old to be a child of my father. I found myself wondering if Sophia had concealed a pregnancy. Would that be possible in a village of this size with nosy neighbors? Renzo, being only 3 at the time, might not have noticed if his mother put on weight, but other women would. And then the biggest question of all, if my father had been in the area long enough to fall in love and maybe father a child, where on earth had he been hiding? In Sophia's house? But then Renzo had said that a German soldier had been billeted with them, and surely someone else would have seen him. It didn't make sense. In fact, the most logical thing to do was to leave this place as soon as possible. If Sophia Bartoli had run off with a German and thus broken my father's heart, then I didn't want to know more about her. The afternoon passed without incident. Paola awoke from her nap and we went into the garden to pick vegetables. By the time the sun set, we had a flat cart loaded with wooden trays ready to take to market in the morning. I looked at the cart and wondered if we'd have to pull it up the hill. It looked like really heavy work. Paola left it in the shade at the side of the house.
"In the morning Carlo will come for it," she said. "Now we go and eat."
This evening's meal started with round, white and shiny balls of cheese called mozzarella, along with tomato slices and fresh green basil. Then came the fried artichokes. I found these a little chewy and not as good as the zucchini blossoms had been. But the main course of the veal chops and a rich wine sauce, well, that was heavenly. Afterward, we sat talking until I could pluck up the courage to go back to my room. I didn't like to ask Paola to accompany me, but I did say, "You don't think we are in any danger, do you? I mean, a man was killed right next to my room." Paola shook her head, smiling.
"You are in no danger, my little one. You have had nothing to do with this man, and neither have I. He has met a sad end, but most likely brought it upon himself. Don't worry."
Then she put an arm around my shoulder and walked with me to the little house. I went in and locked the door from the inside. Even so, I found it hard to sleep. I pictured someone finding a way to prise off the bars at the window, or even putting through a hand holding a pistol and shooting me as I slept. I closed the shutters and the window even though it was hot and stuffy, and finally fell asleep in an airless room. I awoke to shouts and leapt up, my heart thudding. It was not quite light, and my head throbbed as if I had drunk too much wine. I opened my door and saw that the cause of the commotion was that a man had arrived with a tractor and was hooking it up to Paola's cart of vegetables while she yelled instructions with much arm-waving. I dressed hurriedly and went to join them.
"Did we wake you, little one?" she said. "I am sorry. I would have let you sleep on and join me later. I have to go up to the village now to set up my stall, but I have left coffee and bread for you on the table. If you would like to join me, come up at your leisure. The bathroom is at your disposal, and Angelina will soon be awake if you need anything."
I realized I had not locked my door behind me when I ran out, so I rushed back. Nothing had been touched. I took my toilet bag, towel, and clean clothes for the day, and locked the door carefully this time before I went over to the farmhouse, had a bath, and then had breakfast. Angelina appeared while I was still eating, rubbing her eyes sleepily.
"It is not easy to be a mother," she said. "The baby, she cries and wants to eat every 2 hours, all night. You are wise to concentrate on your career and not marry. I wish I had studied harder and not let Mario sweep me off my feet."
She paused, and a wistful smile came over her face.
"But he is very handsome."
"You must miss him very much while he is away." She nodded.
"Of course, but he does this for us so that we can save money and maybe open a little business. I pray for that day."
"You are lucky to have your mother to help you."
"Yes, although she can be bossy and tells me how to look after my child. Her ways are old-fashioned, you understand? But she won't listen to new ways that I have read about in books."
"At least she is here," I said. "I still miss my mother. She was a kind person like yours is. She took good care of my father and me."
"You had no brother or sister?"
I shook my head. "My mother was over 40 years old when I was born. It was a late marriage for both my parents. She never thought she would have a child and was surprised when I came along. She told me I was her little miracle."
"I had a brother," Angelina said. "But he died when he was a baby. He caught that disease called polio, you know? So sad. Life is full of sadness, is it not? My mother, she still weeps for my father."
"Yes," I agreed. "Life is full of sadness. But you have a new baby to make you happy."
"If she doesn't want to eat the whole night long," Angelina said, and we both laughed.
"I promised your mother I would come up to the piazza and help her," I said. Soon after, I set off up the hill. It was a cool morning with a few white clouds racing in from the west. Maybe the weather was going to break. I passed nobody on the path and have to confess that I almost ran through the tunnel. But when I reached the village piazza, it was full of activity at this early hour. Paola was already doing a lively trade and looked as if she was glad to see me.
"Ah, you came," she said. "I will put you to work. The basket of apricots needs to be filled again, and the tomatoes, and make sure the basil is not in the sun or it will wilt."
I did as she asked.
"And I promise to bring parsley to the trattoria," she said.
"I'll take it over for you," I volunteered. She shook her head.
"No, I'd better go myself. I need to know what they might need for the festival tomorrow."
"A festival?" She smiled.
"It is a holy day. Corpus Christi. We have a big procession and then a feast in the piazza here. Everyone brings food to share. You will enjoy it, I am sure."
So off she went. I was a little nervous that I wouldn't be able to understand her customers, but nobody came for several minutes. I was moving the tray of tomatoes out of the direct sun when I saw the shadow of someone approaching. I looked up, and it was Renzo.
"Oh, it is you," he said in English. "Why are you still here?"
"I'm not allowed to leave yet," I said.
"Is this not Paola's stall?"
he asked, looking around.
"Where is she?"
"She went to take parsley to the trattoria," I said. "May I help you?"
"Yes, I suppose so. I need all your tomatoes, and your basil and onions. And do you have garlic? I need a lot of garlic."
"You must be very hungry," I said, trying to be flippant.
"It is the feast day tomorrow," he said, not smiling. "My father feeds all of his workers. He will roast lambs on a spit,
and I am instructed to organize the salads and pasta to go with them.
He has many workers? I asked.
He has much land, Renzo said. Olive groves, vineyards, the olive press. He is a wealthy man.
And you will inherit it all one day? I said. You have no brothers or sisters?
My father never married, he said. He told me that the girl he loved did not love him, and he wanted no other. Such true love should be applauded, don't you think?
Yes, I suppose so, I said, hesitating. But I don't think I'd choose to be alone for my whole life if I couldn't have the person I wanted. I was surprised to hear myself say those words. Did that mean I was ready to move on from Adrian, and there was a light at the end of that tunnel? I glanced up at Renzo. So, when you want to get married, you'll have to choose a girl who will be willing to live here, or Cosimo will be alone. There was something I couldn't quite read in his face.
Yes, he said. Any future wife would have to be willing to be part of my life here. That may not be so easy. Who would want to shut themselves away in the middle of the countryside?
It's very beautiful here, I said.
Maybe.
But you had dreams of being a chef, I said. You gave them up to take care of your adopted father. That is commendable. I regret that I left my father alone so much.
Your father is now dead?
Yes, he died a month ago. That is why I am here, because I wanted to know what happened to him in the war.
Then I am sorry we can't help you, he said in a more civil tone.
We stopped talking as a man approached the table. Excuse me, I said to Renzo. I must take care of this customer for Paola. I just hope I can understand him. The local dialect is hard for me. The man was wearing a light suit and had an impressive black moustache.
You are Signorina Langley?
He asked. Si, signor.
You will please come with me. I am Inspector Dotelli of the Criminal Investigation Department in Lucca. I need to ask you questions concerning the death of Gianni Martinelli.
Chapter 23 Joanna June 1973 I tried not to let alarm show on my face. But I made a statement, I said. Actually, with my Italian being quite basic still, I said, I told the man what I had seen. The inspector spread his hands.
A mere formality, he said. You will come with me to the police station.
I am watching this stall for Signora Rossini, I said. I cannot leave until she returns.
This man can watch for you, he said,
waving dismissively at Renzo. This man is an important customer. He was buying vegetables for the festival tomorrow, I said, feeling my face turning bright red with embarrassment. I could not ask him to spend more time. I was stumbling over the Italian words now, flustered. I do not know how to answer your questions, I added. I speak only a little Italian. I am a visitor from England.
But you were speaking with this man. I saw you.
The inspector wagged an accusing finger. He certainly used his hands a lot in his speech. That was because we were speaking English, I said. This man worked in London.
Then he shall come with you to be your translator,
the inspector said.
I have business that needs to be taken care of, Renzo said coldly. I don't have time. I am not requesting, the inspector said. This is a command from the police. It should not take long.
He looked up.
Ah, here comes the lady now, returning to her vegetables. Good. Come with me.
Paola was rushing towards us, her face ready to do battle.
What is this? What is going on?
She demanded. The inspector from Lucca, I said, nodding at him. He wishes to ask me questions.
We have told the carabinieri all that we know, Paola said. This young lady is a stranger here. She cannot help you, and I do not wish her to be upset. She will not be upset if she answers my questions and tells me the truth. Come, follow me now. It is Saturday, and I wish to get this matter sorted out as quickly as you do.
With that, he put a hand on my elbow and literally steered me across the piazza to the municipal building. I glanced back at Renzo. He was speaking with Paola, presumably reserving the items that he wanted. He was still giving her instructions as he followed us toward the dark doorway. The young Carabinieri agent was turned out of his desk with a mere wave of the hand. The inspector took his place.
"You will stay and take notes,"
the inspector said to the agent who was about to sneak from the room.
"Bring a chair for the young lady, and you may sit at the desk beside me."
The young man returned with a chair, and then took his place beside the inspector, looking extremely uncomfortable. There was no chair for Renzo. He stood behind me. I was not only embarrassed now, I was scared. I had seen the contempt for me in Renzo's face. What if he mistranslated my answers to make me seem guilty of Gianni's murder? My heart was thudding in my chest.
"Now," the inspector said, "your name, your address, and the reason for your visit."
I looked up at Renzo, wanting to give the impression that I didn't even understand these simple commands. I slowly gave my name and address. I came here because my father was a British pilot. His plane was shot down near here in the war, and I wanted to see the spot for myself. Renzo translated this. The inspector nodded.
"You arrived in this town when?"
"Only 2 days ago." It felt much longer.
"And you were the one who found the body of Gianni Martinelli?"
"Signora Rossini and I found the body together," I said. "I sleep in the little house at the bottom of her garden. The water comes from the well behind my room. I wanted to take a shower, but there was no water. I went to find the signora and told her. Together we lifted the heavy lid from the well and saw the body. We both screamed and were very upset." The inspector listened to the translation, then watched a young policeman writing down notes. He looked up at me.
"What did you do then?"
"We sent the signora's daughter to fetch the carabinieri. They came and removed the body from the well. It wasn't easy. Someone had stuffed him in head first so that his head was in the water. It was horrible."
"Did you recognize the man when they brought him out?"
"I did," I said. "I had seen him the night before."
"Ah, so you knew him?"
"I didn't know him. He was one of the men who were sitting around the table in the piazza. I asked them if they remembered my father, but none of them did."
"That is all?"
"Yes," I said. "That was the only time I ever saw this man." There was an unpleasant smirk on the inspector's face now.
"That is not what I hear," he said. "I heard that Gianni was most interested in you. He flirted with you. He offered to show you his farm."
Renzo's face was now also showing embarrassment as he translated. "He was only being friendly," I said. "I told the men that I would like to see the neighborhood, and this man, Gianni, offered to show me how he made cheese."
"How he made cheese? Is that what they call it now?"
The inspector looked at the young agent and chuckled. My uneasiness was displaying itself as anger now. "Inspector, I was sitting at a table with other men. They laughed and said that I should watch out for Gianni, so I was aware that he was perhaps not to be trusted. So when he offered to walk me home, I refused. And luckily, another man called Alberto said he would escort me, as he had to go past Paola's farm on his way home."
"So that was the last time you saw Gianni?"
"The only time." There was a long pause while the inspector stared at me.
"So tell me, Signorina Langley, is it normal in your country for a girl to approach a table full of men alone, to accept a glass of wine from them? This is accepted behavior?"
"First, I am not a girl. I am a woman of 25, and I am about to take the exam to become a lawyer," I said. I thought I detected a flicker of reaction at the word lawyer. "And second," I went on, "I wanted to find out about my father, and I felt quite safe approaching people in the town piazza. I accepted a glass of wine because it would have been rude to refuse."
"And then?"
"Then I walked home. I already told you a man called Alberto offered to escort me since he had to pass the farmhouse where I am staying. I accepted his offer as it was getting dark. He escorted me to the front door. I thanked him and went in to have dinner with Signora Rossini and her daughter. Then I went to bed. That's all I can tell you."
"You heard nothing after that?"
A man was killed and pushed into a well and you heard nothing. I find this strange. Unbelievable, almost.
I drank wine, I said. I am not used to it, and it must have made me sleep extra soundly. He made a sound half between a cough and a laugh.
You know what I think?
The inspector said.
I think that Gianni was attracted to you. A young lady from a distant city, maybe with different standards from our local girls. He has heard about London girls and their loose ways. He wanted to make a conquest. He came to your room to see you later that night. Maybe he tried to force himself on you. You resisted. You hit him with a rock and knocked him out. Then, frightened by what you had done, you hid his body in the well.
That is absurd, I said, looking up at Renzo to translate for me. For one thing, I would not have been strong enough to hit a man like Gianni over the head if he was already attacking me.
Very well. Let us say that you pushed him away. A commendable action for an upright young woman. He tripped, fell backward, and struck his head against a rock. Not murder at all, but self-defense. Understandable. Any jury would see that you were defending your honor.
He paused again. But not true, I said. And how could I have put his body into the well? I told you I was not strong enough to lift the lid alone.
So you got the signora to help you?
He wagged his finger at me again.
Together you pushed this poor man into the well, where he drowned.
I took a deep breath, fighting to remain calm and in control as Renzo translated. If I had done as you say and stuffed his body into the well, would I have alerted the signora in the morning that I had no water for my shower? Would we have removed the cover, found the body, and then called the carabinieri? No, I would have kept quiet about the body. I would have left the town, caught the first train back to England, and by the time anybody discovered the body, I would have been gone. The inspector listened to this as it was translated into Italian. I realized I was waving my arms as I spoke, in true Italian fashion. I noticed a strange expression crossing Renzo's face. Then he said,
I can waste no more time on this, Inspector. I have business to attend to. You will please excuse me. It is quite obvious that this young woman did not kill Gianni.
Then why? The inspector said. Were her fingerprints on a big stone found beside the well? Answer me that one.
I can answer, I said, not waiting for Renzo to translate. That stone was on top of the lid. I lifted it down first when I attempted to open the lid.
Ah, so you do speak Italian,
the inspector said. Not well enough to say what I want to, I answered, and I don't understand when people speak rapidly.
We will leave this matter until next week,
the inspector said.
I am not convinced that she is innocent. I will need to question the Signora Rossini as well. She may have been a partner in crime. But I will get a confession out of her if she is guilty. We need to do more tests, question more witnesses. The whole place will be searched for clues and fingerprints. But I will be kind to you, Signorina. I will not take you to the jail in Lucca. I will permit you to stay here in this town until we get to the bottom of this crime. You are not permitted to leave. Do you understand?
I nodded.
Very well. You may go for now.
He waved us out of the room. As I came out of the darkness into the bright daylight, my wrist was grabbed. I gasped, struggled, and looked up at my attacker. It was Renzo. He was glaring at me, a look of fury on his face.
Where did you get that ring?
He demanded.
Have you robbed my house?
I looked down at my hand. It is my signet ring, I said. My family crest. My father gave it to me for my 21st birthday.
But no, you are wrong, Renzo said. It is my family crest. My family. Your father must have stolen it while he was here.
Absolute rubbish. I shouted the words, fear and anger now combining. See the crest on it? It is the griffin. The same crest is carved over the front entrance of Langley Hall. It has been in our family since 1600. I saw uncertainty on his face now.
But I have an identical ring at home, he said. It is a man's ring and was found among my mother's possessions. Cosimo told me that it came from my real father's family, from the Bartolis.
He said I should be proud that we were once nobility.
Then Cosimo was wrong, I said, realizing as I said it that Cosimo hadn't known the truth. He had not known about my father. But I was feeling excited now. This was absolute proof that my father had been here, that he had known Sophia. I looked up at Renzo's face, now frowning with confusion. I think my father must have given this to your mother as a token of his love. Now we know he was here in this place and he did know your mother. Are you sure you do not remember him? An Englishman with light brown hair and blue eyes, slender in build like me. He shook his head.
I never saw him, he said. What makes you think that he knew my mother? What brought you here?
Well, the ring is proof, isn't it? And I have a letter that he wrote to her, I said. A love letter. He told her that as soon as the war was over, he was coming back for her. He was going to marry her. I paused, feeling the intense emotion in what I was saying. But the letter was returned unopened. The stamp on it said, not known at this address. He kept it locked away in a little box all these years.
She had gone with the German, he said. She chose not to wait for your father.
I nodded, feeling close to tears. We stood there in the bright sunlight, staring at each other.
Then your father and I were both abandoned, he said.
Chapter 24 Joanna, June 1973.
We looked up as we heard Paola calling.
Your tomatoes, Signor Bartoli. Do you have a car to transport them?
I will send one of the men up later on, Renzo said. But I will pay you now. Keep them out of the sun, please.
He took out a wallet and handed over several notes. Paola beamed.
You are most generous.
I turned to Renzo. Thank you for translating for me. I could not have got through that interview without you.
Don't worry, he said. I am sure the inspector realizes that you are completely innocent of this crime. Sometimes these men enjoy wielding their power. Or maybe he is just lazy. He goes for the most obvious suspect. But I will speak with Cosimo and he will make sure that you are released. My father has great influence in these parts.
Why do you think this man was killed? I couldn't resist asking. Renzo shrugged.
I can think of several reasons. He mixed with the wrong type of people. He poked his nose where it wasn't wanted. Maybe he overheard things he should not have heard. Maybe he even resorted to blackmail. I wouldn't have put it past him.
I told myself to shut up, but I went on. I understand he also wanted to build his own olive press. Might someone have wanted to stop him from doing that? Renzo shook his head.
Just one of Gianni's big ideas. It would never have happened. Everyone knows that Cosimo's olive press is the most modern and efficient in this area. Why should anyone build another one? Especially a man like Gianni, who would undoubtedly have cut corners and constructed a shoddy product. It would constantly have broken down, even if anyone would have lent him the capital in the first place.
He gave me a curt little bow.
I must get back to my business. I'm already late. Maybe I will see you at the festival tomorrow? You should come. I think you would enjoy it. Very un-British.
And he smiled as he turned away. I watched him go. Such an attractive man, I thought. Then I reminded myself that he was Cosimo's adopted son. It was quite possible that he knew who killed Gianni. If Cosimo wanted to stop the olive press from being constructed, he had plenty of men to do his bidding, including a son. I must not forget that Renzo might have had a hand in the murder, I thought. I went to join Paola at her stall as Renzo stopped to talk with some men on the far side of the piazza. Gianni's death probably had nothing to do with the olive press, I reasoned to myself. He had tried to speak with me alone. He wanted to tell me the truth about the war, about Sophia. He had put the envelope through my window, and someone had followed him and killed him. Something had happened in the wartime here, something to do with blood and German money. I manned the stall with Paola all day, then helped her pack up the crates and few remaining vegetables. She looked pleased.
Almost everything sold, thanks to Cosimo and Renzo.
Now we will not have to eat vegetable soup for a week.
We walked home together. It was strange, but it actually did feel like walking home.
That stupid man, that inspector, she said. But that is how the police are in these parts sometimes. They don't want to delve into anything that might be too dark and complicated. So they try to pin a crime on the most innocent of people. He probably has a good idea that Gianni was mixed up in criminal activities, but doubtless he wants to steer clear of any gangs. But don't worry, she added. Nothing will come of this. You will soon be allowed to leave, I promise you. And in the meantime, I shall teach you to cook good Italian food, so that when you have a husband, you keep him satisfied.
In spite of everything, this made me laugh. Tell me about the war, I said carefully. Were there any scandals around here? Any people who worked with the Germans?
I told you, I was not here, she said. I only returned after the Germans had left. One heard plenty of tales of horror, of course, of young girls violated, of whole villages massacred because the Germans believed they had aided the partisans.
Who were the partisans exactly? I asked.
Brave groups of men who worked against the occupiers, she said. It was no true organization, just small independent groups acting in the areas where they lived. Some were fascist, some were communist, some were ex-soldiers. Some were just good men who wanted to help win the war. They destroyed trucks and blew up rail lines. They did many courageous things, and many paid with their lives.
There was a group in this area, then?
There was, until someone betrayed them. The Germans mowed them down. Cosimo was only a young man then. He was one of them. He was fortunate. The German bullet only grazed him, but he had to lie among the bodies, pretending to be dead, as the Germans went among them with bayonets. He was half mad with grief and covered in blood when he managed to stumble home the next day. The people of San Salvatore were lucky that they were not all executed in reprisal, as happened with other towns.
Would the people of San Salvatore have known who the partisans were? I asked. Wouldn't the men have kept their identity secret?
Of course, but people always knew. They relied on the farmers to hide them when they were being pursued. They relied on others to feed them when they were away from their homes. And they sometimes wore a little star, so that people knew they were who they claimed to be. So yes, people knew.
People knew, I thought. And one of those people had betrayed the local boys to the Germans. Why? Who had prospered from it? Or maybe it was a case of who had been released from German custody by giving this information. I thought of those men sitting around the table, and wondered how I could ever find out what they might know. We reached the farmhouse and stacked the crates, and Paola went for her afternoon snooze. I, too, would have liked to sleep, but I was too tense. So I sat with Angelina as she took care of the baby.
"Would you like to hold her?" she asked suddenly.
"Here." And the child was in my arms. I felt the tiny, warm body, surprisingly heavy for its size. So perfect, I thought. A perfect little person. Little dark eyes looked up at me, staring at me with interest. "Hello," I said. "You don't know me, do you?" And I thought I detected the glimmer of a smile. "She is beautiful," I said.
"Yes, isn't she? The most perfect baby ever," Angelina said. "When she was born early, they said she might not live. But I prayed to St. Anne and to the Blessed Mother, and they heard me. And now look at her, getting fatter every day thanks to my good milk. When Mario comes home, he will be so delighted to see her."
I looked down at the tiny mite in my arms, her eyes already fluttering back to sleep. I couldn't have done this alone, I thought. To rear a child, one needs a Mario who will come home and be delighted, and a grandma who takes care of mother and baby. That evening, Paola said she was tired and we would have a simple meal. She whipped up eggs and made a frittata with a few vegetables we had brought home, onions and zucchini and beans. It was surprisingly good.
"An early night, I think," she said after we had finished our meal with cheese and fruit. "Tomorrow is a big day.
First the mass at 8 o'clock, then the procession, and then the feast. Will you come?
Oh, yes, of course. I'd like to see it.
You are not of our faith, I think, she said.
I didn't like to say I wasn't really of any faith. I was raised in the Church of England, I said. It is similar, I think.
I hear that in England there is no devotion to religion. You do not honor the saints, is that right? You do not pray to them.
That's true, I said. She made a dismissive noise.
Then how can prayers be answered if you do not call upon the saints to help? God is obviously too busy to do everything alone.
I thought how sweet and simple this was. But then I remembered the little medal on a ribbon that had been in my father's box. Someone had given that to him, probably Sophia. I wondered which saint was represented on it. It seemed so unlikely for my cold and typically English father to have worn a medal on a ribbon. He must have loved her very much, I thought. I remembered the paintings done before the war, so bright and full of life. And it came to me as a shock that his life essentially ended when that letter was returned to him unopened. I wondered how many further attempts he made to trace her, until he gave up and married my solid and dependable mother.
Chapter 25. Hugo. December 1944. The weather turned freezing wet and miserable. Hugo huddled in his shelter for several days while rain and sleet splashed around him. Sophia came at night, her hair plastered to her forehead and her clothing sodden. "Don't come when it's raining like this. I can survive, I assure you. And you'll catch pneumonia if you get so cold and wet," he begged.
"I am strong, Hugo. I'm used to a hard life. Don't worry about me," she said.
"But how will you explain your wet clothes? Your grandmother will be suspicious."
"The nonna can no longer climb the stairs. I dry my things in the linen closet."
She gave him a mischievous smile.
"Don't worry."
But he couldn't help worrying. One night, the storm was so bad that Sophia didn't come. Thunder crashed overhead. Lightning lit up the sky above. Hugo sat up, relatively dry, under the part of the parachute he had kept, worrying about her. What if she had tried to come and was struck by lightning? What if a tree branch had fallen on her? He also felt the gnawing of hunger. As he was growing stronger, so his need for food had increased. He faced the sobering reality that if something happened to Sophia, he would starve, unless he managed to trap more birds. But the thought of eating a bird raw was so repugnant that he brushed it aside. "I must practice walking," he thought. "I must get used to using this leg. In the morning I will try." But in the morning the rain continued in a solid sheet, until the floor around him resembled a small lake. He huddled miserably in his corner while the rain drummed on the altar above him, and his spirits sank lower and lower. "Let's face it," he thought. "My chances of escaping are pretty much nil. The Germans are still all over the place. The Allies won't try pushing north into the mountains until spring. And even if I could make my way down the mountain to the road, I'd never be able to run and hide if the Germans spotted me." But he couldn't just give up and give in. It was his duty as a British officer to do whatever he could to rejoin his squadron. And as long as there was hope of seeing Sophia again, then that spark would keep him going. By mid-afternoon, the rain stopped. The sun came out, and the lake on the floor steamed. Hugo emerged from his hiding place and spread the parachute out to dry. The sheepskin and blanket were miraculously not too damp. Then he made his way carefully around the edge of the pool on the floor and stood outside, enjoying the feel of sunlight on his face. Clouds still clung to some of the hilltops, and he noticed that snow now covered more of the mountain peaks. Once outside on the wet forecourt, he tried to make himself walk, putting weight on his leg. He cried out in pain, and it would have buckled if he had not been wearing the splint. So much for that thought. He tucked the crutch branch under his armpit and hobbled the rest of the way to the rain barrel, where he had a long drink and washed his face. "A bath," he thought. "A long, hot bath." And he pictured the bathroom at Langley Hall with its big clawfoot tub and the steaming water. "I will never take anything for granted again," he decided. His musing was interrupted by the sound of an engine coming from the road below. Several army vehicles, small as a child's toy cars, were making their way north. Instinctively, he ducked behind a section of wall. Then his ears picked up another sound, the deep throbbing hum of a plane engine. Not a German plane. Not British, either. Then he saw it coming out of the south, an American light bomber, he surmised. It came lower until he could see the sun shining on the American star. It was right over the German convoy, and then a bomb fell, then another. He felt the reverberation even up on his hilltop. Then there were secondary explosions as fuel tanks blew up. The smoke from the fireball reached his nostrils. The plane flew on, and all that remained of the convoy was flickering flames. It was a sobering thought that even here war was never far away. But at the same time he took heart in the knowledge that the Allies were hunting out the Germans, destroying them as they fled northward. Perhaps the war really was going to end soon. On his way back to his hiding place, he noticed a feather on the floor from the pigeon he had killed. He bent to pick it up. It was a beautiful bluish-grey with iridescence at the edges. Again he felt a pang of regret that he had killed something so beautiful and so harmless. He tucked the feather into his breast pocket and hobbled back across the chapel. That night he rearranged his bed and wondered if Sophia would come. His hunger by now was so intense that he could think of little else. He fantasized about roast beef and Yorkshire pudding, lamb chops, steak and kidney pie. He retrieved the tin he had found among the rubble and wondered if he could open it with his knife. He had meant to give it to Sophia, but she had been so excited with the pigeon and the parachute silk that he had saved the surprise for later. He turned it over in his hand, then put it down. He would only risk damaging the blade of his knife. And what if it was something that was inedible until cooked? Tomato paste, for example. She would surely come tonight, and maybe bring some of that pigeon stew with her. But she didn't come. He sat up most of the night listening for any sound, but nothing stirred except the gentle sigh of the wind in the trees and grass. 2 nights without her. Something must have happened. He let his mind wander through scenarios. The Germans had returned and taken her. She had been struck by lightning in the storm. She had been taken sick and was now lying there, deathly ill. And he found himself praying as he had never prayed before. I don't care what happens to me, God. Only keep her safe. And then he added a similar prayer to the Virgin Mary, just in case. He must have drifted off to sleep because he heard his name being called as if from far off. He opened his eyes to see her, standing in the doorway, silhouetted against bright sunlight.
Jesu Maria, she exclaimed. Look at all this water. You are lucky you didn't drown.
And she came toward him.
My poor, poor Ugo, she said. I'm so sorry that I left you alone for so long. The night of the storm, when I wanted to slip away, it was impossible.
I understand that, Hugo said. I did not want you to risk coming out in such a storm.
I would have come, she said. But my son is sick. He had a high fever. He wanted to sleep with his mama, and he is afraid of thunder. He was awake and clinging to me all night, and yesterday his fever was worse. We had to call the doctor. The doctor says he has tonsillitis and really should have his tonsils removed.
The words were unfamiliar to Hugo until she gestured to her throat.
Ah, yes, tonsils, he said.
But of course we cannot get to the nearest hospital. There is no transportation, so the doctor gave him some of those sulfur drugs and hoped he would get better.
And is there any improvement?
She nodded.
He cuddled against me all night. The poor child was soaked in sweat. This morning he is weak, but the fever is down, saints be praised.
No doubt you had a talk with Saint Blaise, Hugo said, trying to make her smile. But she frowned at him.
Never mock the power of the saints, Ugo. They are the ones who intercede for us with God. And yes, I did pray to Saint Blaise.
I'm sorry, I was not mocking. I just wanted to make you smile, he said. But you should not have come in daylight. There were Germans on the road below yesterday.
We saw. The Americans bombed them. That was good, no? And our partisans, they also ambushed a vehicle full of Germans and slit their throats.
Aren't you worried that the Germans will retaliate for such actions? He asked.
How would they find out which village the partisans come from? For all they know, it could be English or American soldiers creeping through the dark.
All the same,